You're listening to Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 FM, Media Bites, the Madness in the Message Radio Hour. This is Ron Placone, your host. My guest today, I am very excited about. This guy is a brilliant media scholar, has done tons of work, has so many books out, I can't keep up with him, Dr. Robert McChesney. Dr. McChesney, thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure, Ron.
So you just got off your book tour for Dollarocracy, which I have not read yet. You have a lot of books out, and admittedly, I can't keep up with you. But how did that tour go?
Well, actually, we're in the middle of it. We've done two legs of it, the East Coast and New York, Philly, Washington, and then last time we did New England, Boston, Providence, upstate New York. And we still have trips to Denver, California, Pacific Northwest, and day trips to Chicago and Milwaukee over the next 4 or 5 weeks. So it's halfway through, and so far the tour has been fantastic.
Okay, great. And that's you co-authored that with John Nichols.
That's right. John and I have written 5 books together. This is our most recent. It's called Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America.
Now, one of the things I want to ask you, because you've just been so involved with these issues for so long, and, you know, a lot of times, you know, the problem of the media, which is the title to one of your books, is just kind of a hard thing to get across at times. So in your own words, you know, if you were to encounter somebody that was totally unfamiliar with what you're doing, totally unfamiliar with concepts like media reform, and they asked you, you know, what it was you did, you know, what would you tell them? What would you tell them the problem of the media is?
Well, I tell them I study media systems and that the way a media system is structured strongly influences the type of content on it. So I'm interested in the structures, first and foremost. And then media structures, how the types of businesses or institutions we have and the way they operate and the values they have are oftentimes determined through the government policies, direct and indirect subsidies, rules, regulations, licenses. And so I'm very interested in the political debates over media policy, because oftentimes that's sort of the nucleus of the atom. And if you get into those, you can see what the alternatives were that were possible, why we got the type of system we got, and with what effect.
Okay. Now, something that I wanted to bring up was in a more recent book of yours, Digital Disconnect. You talked about the internet a lot in that book, and one of kind of the themes I saw was it was sort of a reminder that, yes, we have the internet, yes, it is a valuable tool, but it has its issues as well, and you brought about a lot of the monopolization of the internet and so forth. Now, one of the things that I've gotten has been, you know, sometimes people say when you bring up the issues of the problem of the media structure in the United States, you know, people say, well, you have the internet, and that's totally unregulated, you know, so anyone can do anything there. But this book kind of addresses how, well, that doesn't mean it's necessarily a level playing field. So what's kind of the intent of Digital Disconnect, kind of a way of rallying this troop, so to speak, and say, hey, we still have work to do?
I don't think the troops really need to be rallied on those terms. I think people have got their eyes open and their brain open and realizes, oh, we've got a heck of a lot of work to do. This internet has not solved much for us.
Mm-hmm.
And our society is deeply flawed and certainly no better off than it was 20 years ago in core respects, or 30 years ago. I wouldn't know if to rally the troops as much as to say that the way we thought about the internet as a society, the way our public intellectuals talk about it, the popular treatment of it, has had some really interesting insights and it's had great value, but it's tended to be off the mark in one crucial way. There's, you know, you have the celebrants, the optimists who praise the internet as being this revolutionary force, like your friends who tell you it solves all our media problems because everyone can do their own thing and tell it like it is. And then you've got the skeptics who point out the idiocy of many of the celebrants' claims and how the internet is at best a mixed bag and has some very negative consequences, arguably, for people. And my argument is both those sides, or two sides of the dominant coin, miss the fact that we have to really understand the internet's relationship to capitalism, corporations, the profit motive. Now, this is the driving force of our society. The real measure of the internet, ultimately, it's going to be whether it increases the democratization of our society, which means lessening the power of corporate interests and capital. And if it flunks that test, then whatever else it does is probably only going to be of some value. It certainly won't be an unambiguously progressive force. And in the book, I argue, the internet, as it's presently constructed in the United States, is doing far less good than it's capable of, and it's actually flunking the test.
So one of the other things I wanted to bring up, and this goes back to your book on journalism, the one that I believe was The Life and Death of American Journalism. One of the solutions that you posed in that book was the idea of a kind of rise in digital nonprofit newspapers. And I wondered if you could expand on that for our listeners.
Commercial journalism is dead. It's dying. It's never coming back. And this is something that's been very hard for most Americans, and I suspect most of your listeners, to get their heads around, because no one wants to really talk about it too much. But it's the reason why Jeff Bezos could buy the Washington Post for $250 million. When a decade ago, he probably would have had to spend $5 billion or $6 billion to buy it. It's because capitalists have wisely determined, accurately determined, you can't make money doing journalism, so they're jumping ship. And this isn't just old media. That's sort of baloney, but oh, that's just the old media. We're rocking and rolling online. And it's worse online than the old media. Like, the old media is one that sustains journalism online for the most part. Commercial journalism, dead, gone, not coming back. And the reason for this is simply that there's a complex reason, but the short answer is simply that advertising is going through a fundamental revolution online that's going to change the way advertising is done. That advertisers no longer go to a content website or like a newspaper or magazine would have been offline and say, we want to reach your visitors, so we're going to give you a lot of money to place ads on your website, and then we can reach your visitors, and then you can use some of the money to put up content that will attract the people we want to hit. That was the old logic of commercial newspaper publishing and commercial media. Well, online, advertisers don't do that anymore. They've got a more efficient way. They simply go to one of the great ad networks, AOL, Microsoft, Yahoo, or Google, and say, hey, we want to buy 30 million women 25 to 29 years old who might be interested in purchasing our product. And they'll find those 30 million women instantly at whatever websites they're at. And it doesn't have to be a media website. It could be the Target website or Best Buy or anything. They could be Googling something crazily. They'll find them wherever they go. Because we now know that they know everywhere you go online. They know everything, everywhere anyone listening to this goes online pretty much at all times. They've got you completely monitored. So advertisers don't have to subsidize media or journalism or content production to reach us. They go directly to us. And because of this, there's really no money left for journalism online or content. Let's stick with journalism for now. So we're in a real crisis today. Most elections don't get covered. Most types of government barely have any reporters left covering them. There's just a shocking lack of coverage of public affairs. And any democratic theory around that doesn't work. I mean, the framers of this country made creating a viable press the central mission for the whole edifice of American democracy. Without it, it didn't work. Supreme Court's reinforced that notion every time it's considered the matter. So this is a great crisis for us. The internet is not solving, and it's not going to make better. It's only made permanent the end of commercial journalism. And what I write about in my most recent books, and been writing about for a long time, it's a central concern of mine, is that understand journalism not as a commercial undertaking, but really as a public good, something the public society needs, but that the market can't generate sufficient quality or quantity, is really the way we have to understand it, and the way I think most places in the world do understand it. And understood that way, we look at the founders of this country who instituted enormous postal and printing subsidies to create a massive newspaper culture that never would have existed had it just been left to the profit motive. They subsidized newspapers in this country, and the smaller the newspaper was, probably the greater the subsidy was as a percentage of its expenses. And that gave us the greatest print media in the 19th century in the world, by far, the envy of the world. And we have to think in those terms again. We've got to come up with ways to make it so people can make a living doing journalism. We have independent, competing newsrooms in community as a community. They'll have probably to be nonprofit, non-commercial, given the market's lack of interest. And find ways to make that happen. Otherwise, the future for political culture in this country is bleak.
So for those just tuning in, you're listening to Media Bites, the Madness and the Message Radio Hour, right here on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 FM. I'm joined today by Dr. Robert McChesney, one of the foremost media scholars at the University of Illinois, and he's written a lot of books, and we're talking about some of the problems going on in the media right now, as well as some solutions. So Dr. McChesney, I wanted to ask you this. This is something that I've encountered a bit. And someone else brought this up to me, and I kind of saw this a bit in my master's degree, and I wanted to ask you about this as someone who has seen success on both ends of the spectrum. A colleague of mine put it this way, that there seems to be kind of a disconnect when it comes to media advocacy and so forth. There seems to be a disconnect between people in the practical arena, people, you know, doing online journalism and stuff like that, and advocating for media reform and so forth, and then people that are kind of in the academy doing theory. You've seen success on both ends of that spectrum, both in the academy and outside, you know, with your work with Free Press and so forth. So is that something you'd agree with? Like, do you feel like there's kind of like not a lot of interaction between the two worlds?
Probably true. I mean, you could have online journalists and producers. You could also just separate that out from political activists on media and communication issues. And then there's also academics. Yeah, I think that there hasn't been an overwhelming amount of overlap between the various groups.
Do you see that as a problem?
Yes and no. Considering what most academics are doing, it's probably lucky for everyone else they're not having to deal with them. Most of the work is so irrelevant to the human rights. You know, not all by any means, and I cite lots of it, but I think for all the resources that go to communication programs in the United States, if you look at their actual research being done, I think a far too low percentage of it really has any relevance to the great issues of our times. A lot of it's just gibberish. And so the people doing gibberish stay out of the way of people trying to do something effective. They're doing us a favor. I don't think we need to worry about them. I think a bigger concern is making academics just do better, more interesting, more relevant, more pertinent work. Then I think it would be a real concern.
Well, do you see that changing in the future then?
Yes and no. I mean, and I wrote a book about 7 years ago that was actually much more optimistic than what I just said, called Communication Revolution. And in that book, I argued that, you know, you can really see now that we are in a moment of fundamental transition politically and in terms of media in the United States, and we're entering such a period that there was a real need for great scholarship and committed scholarship that would address the fundamental issues before us, like how do we have journalism in our society. And there's a whole range of other ones too, that's by no means the only one. And that I was hopeful and optimistic leading research universities would turn to this, and then eventually that would filter through the whole system. I'm a little less optimistic right now, despite the crying need for it. I think it's going to be a harder battle. I mean, what would probably change things if there was a real huge upsurge in political activism? I think that would give some impetus to such sort of research on campuses into sort of relevant issues, but or related to relevant issues. But, you know, right now, if I look at a lot of campuses, I've done a lot of travel, there's some wonderful people doing some great work, but there's a lot of institutional pressure to do mediocre work that will not threaten anyone in power. It's not put in those terms, but those are the results.
Well, is that what made you less optimistic then?
I was looking around, I haven't seen much, and so I'd like to see more. I would have thought we would have had more of a renaissance in critical work and found communication scholars by now than we've had.
Okay. Well, hopefully that'll change. It seems like it needs to. Let me get back to like a more practical question then. For some of our listeners, that this may be the first introduction to the type of work you're doing. And like I said before, you do have a very extensive body of work. If somebody was looking for a book of yours to start with, which one would you recommend?
I'd probably recommend Digital Disconnect. It was written this year. It's about the most pressing immediate set of issues concerning the internet and journalism and democracy. And it goes directly to the core of the issues of capitalism, democracy, and media. And the book was also written it's sort of an interesting book. It's both an advanced book, making a fairly sophisticated argument about the internet and society that engages with fairly high-level debates. But it's also written for a general audience with no background, so I really spell out what all the issues are, the terms, and the background at all points. It's written, I hope, in an accessible voice, not one that uses a lot of terms and jargon that are pretentious and unapproachable for a lay reader.
So what are some of your future plans with publications? I mean, I know right now you're still kind of promoting Dollarocracy, but is there anything else in the works that deals with other issues?
Well, these two books have come out this year, Digital Disconnect and Dollarocracy, were the result of years of work, and so I'm going to be talking about them as much as possible this year and into next year. I've got a bunch of plans of things like the seeds in the ground, so to speak, and things I'm starting to think about. But the one issue that I'm most interested in, and I don't know if it'll be in my next major book or not, but it'll certainly be in there somewhere, is the relationship of socialism to communication and media. I'm trying to get a better sense in socialist theory what role communication plays, and it's what this practice, ranging from the Swedish social democracies of years in the 70s, in particular, the high point of Swedish democracy, to the communist, various communist societies, to democratic socialist theory from people like Raymond Williams, who's a great thinker in this regard. So look at the track record in terms of looking forward, think about as we envision a post-capitalist democratic society, which I think is sort of a political issue we'll all have to increasingly wrestle with, this capitalism is unraveling, how we can envision a free, democratic communication and media sector in such a society. So I think it's going to be a very important policy and political issue for us in the next generation.
So for those just tuning in, you're listening to Media Bites, the Madness and the Message Radio Hour, right here on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 FM. I am joined today by Dr. Robert McChesney, a media scholar and author of the new book, Dollarocracy, as well as Digital Disconnect, which he does recommend to start with for anyone looking to get into his work. Getting back to the practical world, because, you know, I recently got to chat with you a bit at the National Conference for Media Reform in April in Denver. And, of course, FreePress.net is an organization that you were a co-founder of. So you really have a firm grasp on, this world. So I wanted to ask you, are there any activists or artists that you've seen out there recently that are doing some work that you really would care to highlight?
Well, there's so much great stuff. I think the most important thing to say in this regard is that there is a wealth of activism taking place in this country, much more than there was, say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago. But most of it goes beneath the surface to something because news media don't cover activism outside the mainstream, except in rare moments, and then they do a lousy job. And partially because we don't have much media left, so there wouldn't much there to cover. You know, there wouldn't be people to cover anything anyway. But because of that, there's enormous activism going on that most Americans, unless they're participating in it, wouldn't understand unless they saw it firsthand because there's no media coverage. And that's the most important thing to take away. We have people working on constitutional amendments to get money out of politics. We've got people working on environmental issues. We've got now this wonderful new movement, and I'm glad to say Free Press is a big part of it, to stop the government from spying on us and to stop corporations from spying on us online, to make an issue out of this so we have some sense of privacy and keep our liberties and rights protected. I think that is a really exciting movement because it draws together people across the political spectrum. And it shows real promise for going forward. And it's such an important issue to protect our liberties and our freedoms. We lose those any more than we have. Everything else is pretty much done.
So would you say that is, if you had to pick one issue as the most pressing, that would be the one you would select?
No. I mean, I wouldn't answer your question. I'd refuse to, because I think that how does one say taking money out of politics is less important than stopping NSA spying? Mm-hmm. How does one say stopping fracking in a state where, you know, it could end up destroying your agriculture and your groundwater? It's, you know, they should stop doing that to go work on something else. I mean, I think there's there's a whole range of issues that all demand attention. The important point here is that it's not an either-or zero-sum game, that if people work on one, it's going to undermine the other. Because I think what history shows is that when you have success in reform movements against entrenched elite power, it tends to be a process where you get a lot of momentum going and you have a sort of a political moment where everything you're working on becomes in play. And you can win a lot of victories. And until you get to that point where you have a cumulative mass, it's very hard to win anything. And, you know, so the great periods of history, reform periods, revolutionary periods, come in these moments when all of a sudden all of the things get passed that no one thought was possible and get adopted. And then once you're out of those periods, it's very hard to get any sort of social change. So we have to get into one of those periods. And anything that gets people working to get into one of those periods, great reform periods, I'm all in favor of.
Okay. So, you know, a lot of times, like, getting back to just the broad, you know, especially the mission of free press, you know, a better world starts with a better media, you know, which is something I firmly believe, and I'm sure you do as well. And, you know, a lot of times people say when you look at kind of just the anatomy of a revolution, if you will, change happens when it's seen as just absolutely necessary and people start demonstrating that through action. If you had to kind of just take an educated guess, I mean, how much closer do you feel like we are to a significant change in media policy in the United States?
Well, I'd put it this way. What we can do is look at what's going on in our society and say, this isn't really working and it can't last forever. And it's going to be overturned. What we can't do, and I think that's fair to say. I mean, we're in a crisis mode, really. With journalism, with politics, with governance, with our economy, they're way out of kilter and need to be reformed dramatically. But what we can't do, and I think this is what stumbled people a lot, is we can't predict the future ever. Mm-hmm. And the best story I can give about this, and the one I like to tell, is that a professor who was a white South African who came to America in the 1960s. He was a strong opponent of apartheid. And his family all lived in South Africa, and he was knowledgeable in South African politics more than anyone I knew by far. I mean, he studied it, he devoured it. And I went in to meet him when I was leaving Seattle in 1988. He was very down and depressed and depressed. And he said, it's hopeless now. The forces in favor of apartheid will never, ever, ever give up power. They won't negotiate. There's going to be an enormous bloodbath if there's ever going to be justice for black Africans. It's just going to be horrible. And he said, it's just terrible. This was in 1988. He was the smartest guy I knew about South Africa. He said it was the worst it had ever been. It was hopeless. That's what happened then. 2 years later, Nelson Mandela, head of the African National Congress, was released from Robben Island Prison. 3 years after that, Nelson Mandela was elected president of South Africa, the first black president, obviously, in a post-apartheid South Africa. And in that five-year period, there was less violence than you find in a New Jersey bar fight on a Saturday night. So my friend in 1988 was completely wrong. He completely missed what was just about to happen in his own country. He was the most knowledgeable guy in the world on this subject, at least that I knew, outside of South Africa on this subject. And I think that was a very important lesson to me, that, you know, you can't predict the future. And you see what's involved. Yeah, I just don't see that one coming. 1 in 5 chance. I'm not going to work on it. That's not high enough odds to justify me getting off my butt. But if we think like that, it just becomes ridiculous. All we can do, no one saw Occupy coming. No one saw Tahrir Square coming. No one saw the Madison Uprising coming. No one ever sees any of this stuff happening before it happens. All you can do is say, we've got an untenable situation that at some point, something's going to happen. And as individuals, what we can do is we can just simply say, okay, my choice is, now that I see that, is what am I going to do? You look in the mirror and look in your eye and say, okay, what can I do? That's all I can control is what I do. And if you decide to act like social change for the better, it's impossible. Yeah, I don't like the odds of it in my lifetime. So you act like it's impossible, it's not worth doing. Well, then, as far as you're connected to it, you guarantee it is impossible. I mean, if we all act like it can't be done, it won't be done. If we all like it can be done, if we all act, yeah, we can actually change this thing, we absolutely will win away.
Wonderful. And I think that's a solid place to end. Dr. McChesney, thank you so much for joining me today. For all those listening, to learn more about Dr. McChesney and the work that he's a big part of, go to freepress.net. You can learn more about the issues that they're a part of there. You can also get the links to discover all of his books and all of his work. Dr. McChesney, again, thank you so much for joining me today, and I look forward to crossing paths again in the future.
Absolutely, Ron. Me too.
All right.